Welcome to another episode of the Ex-Military Careers Podcast. In this episode, Kendall Barnett sat down with the insightful Robert Marsh, military veteran and director of fundraising at Combat Stress, the UK's leading charity for veterans' mental health. Enjoy.
Thank you for joining us, Robert. I guess to start on my side, of course, you and I have never spoken before, so kind of keen to get an overview of your professional journey, right, within the military after leaving all of that. So maybe to kick things off, if you could just introduce yourself and who you are and your story.
Brilliant. Thanks, Kendall. And shall I just say at the get-go, it's really great to be with you today and talking on this podcast. So I'm the director of fundraising at Combat Stress, which is the UK's leading charity for veterans' mental health. And we specialize in looking after veterans who have got complex mental health needs. So there is now a new diagnosis of CPTSD, so complex PTSD, but PTSD with anxiety and depression and those sorts of things. And I've been working for Combat Stress. In fact, actually, slightly weirdly, I've been at the organization twice. I joined in 2005, worked for them for 6 years, and then left, did something else for four, and then came back in 2015, and I've been with Combat Stress since then. But just a quick romp through my professional career. So I read sciences at university, and I've got a master's, well, I've got a degree in biochemistry, but a master's in neurophysiology. And then I had no idea what I wanted to do when I left university. And I ended up in professional sales. So I worked for a drug company selling hospital pharmaceuticals. My father's a doctor, so it seemed a sort of a reasonable thing to do, given some of the experiences I'd had around the dinner table with my father talking about his work. And it was during that period, and I was living in Edinburgh in Scotland, and on the same street, and I was in a very large flat share, in quite a smart house. And sorry, that's my dog. You might be able to hear groaning in the background.
We're going to dog.
I've got a black Labrador called Bosco.
Adorable.
Actually, funny enough, he's a therapy dog as well. So there's a charity in the UK called Pets as Therapy. And so he's super calm. He goes everywhere with me. In fact, actually, I've got a little Combat Stress cape that he wears. And so at the Cenotaph,
free PR.
I know. Yeah, exactly. Everybody wants to talk to the dog, not to me, but they want to talk to him. And every year, for the last couple of years, he's marched past the Cenotaph on Remembrance Sunday with me and the group of Combat Stress veterans. So he's an absolutely, I wouldn't live without a dog now. They're just fantastic.
I have a dog as well. She is not as calm. I got a Great Dane thinking the temperament would be calm. Okay. But I swear she is absolutely like a golden retriever at heart.
Right. Yes. They're great. They're a fantastic addition to any 20 family or a 20 life, really. I absolutely adore my dog. It's brilliant. I think actually I need the exercise mentally more than he does. So, you know, going out for a walk is never a hardship. And of course, with a Labrador, it doesn't matter whether it's raining, snowing, cold, whatever, he still wants to go. It's just great.
Absolutely. No, I couldn't agree more. And I feel like that routine of having those walks in your day, every day, breaking it up, it just changes everything from a mental health perspective. Yeah.
Exactly. And I live quite close to the River Thames. I'm on the sort of Oxfordshire-Berkshire border. So I'm near a town called Henley-on-Thames where the regatta is. And it's really pretty out here. And there are lots and lots of really, really good walks. And there is also some evidence that being near water is also very good for your mental health as well. So I spend quite a lot of time walking up and down or quite close to the river. Yeah, it's great. Absolutely fab. So where was I? Working for a drug company. And I was living in Edinburgh, and on the same road that we lived on was a retired army officer, and he had just started a reserve role, a second in command of the Scottish Yeomanry. And yeomanry regiments in the UK are reserve cavalry. And I started talking to him, and before I knew what had sort of happened, I'd drawn my kit and I joined and then went through the officer training program, which took a year and a half, 18 months to do all the training and the courses. And then I went to Sandhurst and commissioned into the Scottish Yeomanry. And that was in the early 1990s.
Right.
And after a year of being a reserve officer, I realized that I actually wanted to be a professional soldier. And at that time, you had to be at Sandhurst before your 25th birthday. And I was about 6 months out. I was 24 and a half. So the option was for me to apply to the regular army doing what was called an SSVC, which is a short service voluntary commission. They don't exist now. And I literally went from working for a drug company on a Friday afternoon to being in Germany as a troop leader for a regiment called the Light Dragoons, who are armored reconnaissance. And I spent two just fantastic years with the Light Dragoons. I did an operational tour to Bosnia in 1996, and I also did the professional arms course, which is called Troop Leaders. I was in Canada at BATIS, so the British Army Training Unit, Suffield. I was there for 6 months applying safety to tanks, and absolutely great. I had a wonderful, wonderful time as a regular officer.
Out of curiosity, too, and I apologize for cutting you off, but was there anything, because of course, right, like graduating, you know, school, then going into the pharmaceutical kind of sales space, was there anything that he said to you in that conversation that really resonated with you? You know, I think that's relatable for a lot of people having one conversation or another that's, you know, the trajectory of their career and their lives.
I'd been in the cadets at school, and so I'd always had an interest in the military. And my father had been in the university air squadron when he was at university. And so there was always a little bit of life military running through the family. I was always interested in that. But actually, my experience with the OTC, the Officer Training Corps at university, was not good. I spent a term with the Officer Training Corps at university and didn't really enjoy it. And I thought, well, that's my brush with the military. But I think there have been a couple of people, well, more than a couple of people, but there have been a couple of people who have really inspired me. That chap that I met in Edinburgh who convinced me to join the Scottish Yeomanry. And then actually somebody else who I met on one of the early courses I did as a reserve officer, who was a Light Dragoon. He's a chap called Charlie Mayo. So actually, it's serendipitous, isn't it? You meet some people along your journey, and those are the ones that you think, wow, you've really inspired me to think about doing this or doing that or doing the other. So that was probably, those two were the most pivotal people for how I ended up serving the Light Dragoons, I guess. The other thing that was really, really interesting, and this now informs quite a lot of my fundraising practice now, is the response that I got from the few regiments I applied to when I did the short service voluntary commission. And from the Light Dragoons, I got two handwritten notes, one from the outgoing honorary colonel and one from the incoming honorary colonel. And that, stacked up with the very formulaic printed response letters from other regiments, you line them all up and you thought, which organization really is interested in me as an individual?
Right.
And so actually one of the things that me and my team do at Combat Stress is that we highly personalize our response to donors. And I think that really makes a difference. You know, if you're coming home from a bad day at work, you check your post and you've got a handwritten envelope and then a handwritten letter inside thanking you for a donation, that's really important. And I always write in ink, so I always use fountain pens.
You must have immaculate handwriting.
I do. After all that practice. Well, I spend far too much time typing, but I think... yes, at least people can read it. Let's just say it's legible enough for that. But yes, that whole personal approach, you know, the Light Dragoons was seen very much as a family regiment. And I mean, of all the people that I've met in my professional life, both officers and soldiers, they were a group of people that, you know, epitomize all that is good about the armed forces. Just some really, really stunning individuals. Who together coalesced into this very effective regiment. So I count myself very lucky that they were the regiment that I spent some time as a regular with. Very lucky indeed. So then I left. So I left the Light Dragoons. I went back to the reserves, and I spent another 10, 12 years in the reserves. And then I got married. And then my wife said, you can do two things well, three things it isn't going to work. So work life and married life and my reserve life then came to an end. But all up, I did about 14 years, both as a regular and a reserve. It has really given me the career that I'm doing now, which is, you know, working for Combat Stress as the director of fundraising. That's pretty much my professional journey. The only one difference, the only thing I haven't mentioned is that when I left the Light Dragoons as a regular, I went to Cambridge University, to do a PGCE, which is a postgraduate certificate in education, because I thought I would like to be a teacher. And that was really interesting because the attitude of people who were mentoring and training teachers, the attitude to me as a service leaver was remarkable, and it not in a good way.
Interesting.
And my first mentor said, we didn't quite know what to expect. We thought you would come in and just shout at everybody. I mean, if you're serving on an armored vehicle as the commander, and you're commanding a troop of vehicles, so let's say you have four vehicles, you are also listening to orders from your headquarters or your squadron leader. You're then having to formulate your own plan, disseminate that amongst the people that you're working with. So you don't have time to make a brew or to cook or do those sorts of things. And if you are shouting at people and not being collaborative or a compassionate leader, you know, your tea starts tasting funny pretty quickly. And I think this notion of compassionate leadership is something, you know, if you think about the Aesop tale, the sun and the wind, people want to be encouraged with warmth rather than being motivated by fear. And I would hope that the people I work with now, my direct reports, would say that that is predominantly my leadership style. And you can still be robust, but with respect and compassion, you know, if you're having to performance manage somebody. And I think that's important. I think that the way to look at it is treat people as you would wish to be treated.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, you don't know what you don't know. So I can, you know, understand that people may make presumptions off of, you know, what maybe they're looking at movies or cinema, those sort of things. And they're just assuming, right, that this is day in and day out. But the reality is, and I know from her firsthand experience speaking with so many, you know, leaders who are now veterans, is that most everyone that I've spoken to, especially at the higher levels, tend to have this more calm, let me assess this situation and take it back and I'll come back to you type demeanor, which is actually fueled, I think, a lot of their successes. And a lot of those soft skills that they gain, the kind of learning moments from their peers and from their superiors in the armed forces and just militaries across the board, I mean, tend to be what they use that got them straight into leadership. I was just talking to someone the other day who, you know, had been a leader in the military, then started their software engineering career, and within 2 years, right, was managing a team just because those soft skills, the capability to do so and lead by example and delegate tasks was, you know, natural from that. So that's interesting. I guess coming out of that, I'm keen to understand, was there anything that you noticed about that you were like, you know, how can we kind of change that narrative, right? Because I assume if it's happening in one industry, there may be others who kind of have that sort of, I guess, preconceived notions about who you are if you are ex-military.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because I think one of the things that's most difficult in any organization is cultural change. And so trying to change those preconceived ideas and attitudes is really, really difficult, particularly if you're doing it from the bottom up. I guess the only way that I could hoped to have changed that was by the way that I interacted with everybody. But I think it underpins a wider issue in the UK, which is the armed services are so small that, you know, the regular population or the non-military population don't ordinarily interact with anybody who is in the armed services at all. And in recent years, you know, when there were still the troubles in Northern Ireland, people who were serving the armed forces, whether that was as a regular or as a reservist, hid the fact that they were in the armed services. So you never wore your uniform anywhere. You were very, very careful about letting people know that you're in the, you know, in the armed services. And so by and large, they were hidden because of security and those sorts of things. So the visibility of the armed services more widely in the population was pretty low. And that has changed with conflicts like Iraq and Afghanistan, where, you know, the military have been either the first or the second or the third news item during those conflicts. So they've definitely raised their profile. And other organizations, other charities that have started, certainly during the Afghanistan conflict, have raised the profile of the armed services. But yeah, I think, you know, part of the issue is how it is that perception, that wider perception of what the military do and by token, what veterans can offer to the UK workplace.
Absolutely. I appreciate that. And I guess moving forward, you know, looking back when you did leave, because, you know, you were in the reserves for quite some time, you know, got married and kind of had to take that next step and focus in two areas. So looking back when you did leave, did you feel like you had the right tools and support systems in place to help make that transition into civilian life? I'm conscious here in the U.S., right, there is a little bit more of a pivot with being in reserves and then going out. But how did that look like for you? And did you feel like you had everything you needed?
Well, I had only served as a regular. So it was my full-time life for 2 years, but it was pretty full-on for those 2 years. I do remember when I left, I did feel bereft because, you know, I was in the officer's mess and there were always people around, kindred spirits, all of the same age. And I felt I was a really good fit and I liked everybody that I was working with. But I left and then went straight into something else. But the things that the military provide you, like accommodation, food, you don't have to worry about anything. I mean, of course, I had to fend for myself, as it were, pretty quickly after I left and then went to Cambridge. So it wasn't that difficult. And of course, I'd already sketched out a bit of a career path, which was I would do this qualification to be a teacher and then apply to, you know, teaching roles. That didn't happen, as it turned out. So I completed that course and then realized I didn't want to teach. I mean, one of the things was like I felt that the responsibilities of a teacher were, actually, funny enough, were too much. It was clear that you would get on with some students and you wouldn't get on with others. And I found that very difficult to square away. You know, we can all remember teachers that have really inspired us, but we can also remember teachers who have either killed our self-confidence or turned off a particular avenue when perhaps they shouldn't
Absolutely.
Have done. And yet the fact is we're all human beings. So, you know, they could have been having a bad day. Your reaction to that could have been not what they had intended, all of those things. And I felt that responsibility was too much. And then it was through some former regimental colleagues, two of whom worked at a very well-known public school, that I sort of fell into fundraising. So I used some of my sales skills
network.
And all of that professional training, then the network to land a job in fundraising. So I worked in public schools for about 5 years, and then actually, I was asked to apply for the Royal Order of Combat Stress in 2005 and haven't really looked back.
Wonderful. With the course in teaching, did you have mentors or anybody? I know, of course, you know, in when you're leaving college and whatnot, you have advisors as they're kind of helping you pave your career. Is that how it works for you all in the military? Kind of how did you stumble across, okay, this is what I want to do? Because I think for a lot of people, as they're exiting the military, identifying, okay, what's my next step can be the hardest decision. And yeah. Curious what tools you were able to leverage to make that.
No, that actually just reminded me there was a mentor who wasn't my mentor. So it wasn't a formalized process. And there isn't, well, there wasn't 20 years ago, there wasn't a formalized process identifying somebody who's a veteran and then linking it up with a mentor in that institution. That would have been really helpful. But I just stumbled across somebody who had been in the army. And I remember going to see her a number of times when I was struggling. And that was really, really helpful because actually, I mean, back then I was thinking, why don't I just, because I was struggling a little bit on this course for various reasons. And the default would have been, well, why don't I just go back into the military? You know, it's something that I know is safe. It's, you know, like a well-worn pair of slippers, you know, that is comfort zone, that sort of stuff. But it was very helpful to have somebody who understood that, spoke veteran, understood the language, you know, that sort of some of the struggles, because she had been through exactly the same thing, but had come out the other side. So that was actually a mentoring program would have been really, really helpful. I think, you know, I think in the UK, those sorts of things are probably getting much better. Some of the work we do with corporates who want to sponsor or get involved in the work that Combat Stress does now have special interest groups, you know, a veteran network or any other sort of network of people who've got similar experiences. So whether that's cycling or gardening or rowing or, you know, whatever, you know, but these veteran networks are also very helpful. And in fact, it's one of the things that we have started doing at Combat Stress is providing veterans with a veteran buddy. You know, it is quite daunting for people to say, I've got a mental health issue, and then come along or try and access our programs. And having somebody who has already been through that process to help somebody else navigate their way through it is really, really helpful. So yeah, that would have been a really good thing.
Yeah, I agree. And even I think navigating, okay, I know something doesn't feel right, right? But I don't really know what it is, right? And I think having somebody, like you said, who's been there and has peers who have been there and has gotten out and they've all kind of seen that struggle. Sometimes I think it's just a slightly more safer place, right? To have those conversations. It feels a little less daunting.
Yes, exactly. It helps to normalize it. One of the fears that people have is, am I the only person that is experiencing this or has experienced it? And actually, if somebody says, no, this is perfectly, perfectly normal, it helps to settle those, you know, those anxieties, I imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I couldn't agree more. Now, you know, I'm cautious that the transition to the civilian world is unique to everyone, but are there particular tools, techniques, you know, pieces of wisdom, I guess, that you have now that you wish you had back then that you might be able to share?
I mean, there are two things that I've thought about. One is I had really underestimated the importance of networking. I think with social media, particularly LinkedIn, which it just seems to, you know, be on the up and up and up, trying to access those opportunities to network with different industries, working out, you know, is this something that I would like to do? Or I think that would have been something I would have convinced my younger self to do more of. And then the other one is not fearing failure. It's not a problem trying something and working out that it's not for you, and then going and trying something else. And I think certainly I heard a statistic that on average, certainly officers, when they leave, they would take three roles before they settle into something that they realize that they either like or are good at. So being prepared to say this isn't working and moving on would have been a good piece of advice. So networking and don't fear failure.
Absolutely. And out of curiosity, I know you brought up, you know, the changing company culture. If I imagine too, right, as you're making that transition, potentially going into a company that has a culture of that sort of mindset, right, around veterans opposed to a veteran-friendly organization, any recommendations on how to vet that out? Or, you know, if looking back, if you could have kind of sensed that out, or questions you could ask ahead of time to identify, okay, am I going to feel the same sense of belonging here that I felt, you know, when I was in the forces?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess you only really feel that when you're actually in within that organization. Okay. I mean, one of the things that the military charity sector in the UK is desperate to try and avoid is painting every veteran as mad, bad, or sad, and they're not. You know, Combat Stress exists to look after veterans who, you know, the small but significant minority of veterans who need mental health help. But the vast majority of people who serve in the armed forces leave and go on to have, you know, really successful careers. So that would be the one thing that I would want to help dismiss is that veterans are mad, bad, and sad, because they're not. They really, really are not. it is amazing actually how many that, you know, you stumble into people that you know you think, good Lord, were you in the army? You know, you're just not a typical army veteran. So yeah, I mean, you know, the spectrum of humanity is reflected by the spectrum of differences in veterans.
I couldn't agree more. I did a podcast with four different, you know, military veterans, all different backgrounds. And it was interesting because I did a call with each of them prior, right, to tell them about ex-military careers and what we're doing and are you interested in doing this? And it was such a, you know, it was all over the spectrum where it's like, this was a huge part of my identity, right? I still work in some sort of organization that's involved in the military. I would love to help, over to, you know, now working in a completely, you know, the what is corporate America, you know, working at these large enterprise companies and very much so saying, I'm happy to, but this wasn't a huge part of my identity. I think what I told, you know, each of them was, that's great, right? It's great to have diversity and thought on this panel because I think it resonates with different people, right? Some people were like, I had a great experience, I moved on, now I'm, you know, living life, and others are, you know, it's a huge part of my identity, or some people struggled, some people didn't. And it's interesting to talk about those things and just make everyone understand that, you know, there's no right answer, right, to the path you choose forward.
Exactly. Exactly. And it is really interesting. If you look at people that I served with 20 years ago, how they've all gone into something totally diverse. I mean, all just, it's amazing. It really is.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. I know a lot of them were on, you know, artillery and whatnot, and then landed on software engineering. I'm like, how did that happen? Yeah.
Exactly.
But agreed. So speaking of, you know, adapting to the unfamiliar, veterans have incredible skill sets, right? Including adaptability that any employer, you know, would be lucky to have. What do you think why do you think some companies can be reluctant to hiring a veteran?
I think, well, we've touched on a little bit of this already.
Stereotypes.
Yeah, that people, are, you know, just think it, you're just going to come and shout at people and be very, I mean, there are some, you know, tropes, aren't there, about the military, that military intelligence is an oxymoron, you know, you're not paid to think, all those sorts of things that get trotted out in a very old series here called Dad's Army. And that actually there's an underlying level of incompetence and pompousness and that sort of stuff. And so I think that informs quite a lot of how people feel about, even still now, about how the military are and how they operate. But it is interesting. If you, I spoke to somebody who ran a painting and decorating company about 4 years ago at an event at the Palace of Westminster. So it was hosted by a group of MPs. And this chap was saying he was desperate to employ more veterans. He had employed one, and this guy had worked out so well. He was just really keen to employ more of them. And the reason was that they always turned up at the right time with the right equipment, with the right mindset. They would get on with people. There was a humor as well. And he just said they were absolutely brilliant. So if we can encourage more organizations to think that way, all the better. And the UK is moving forward all the time, as it is in the US. And so there's an employee recognition scheme in the UK, which I think is really helpful. And so companies sign up to this military covenant. And I think that's a really good thing. So, you know, if you see a little logo at the bottom of somebody's letterhead saying that they are part of the employee recognition scheme, then I think that helps. And, you know, somebody in their HR department might say, what's that? Have a Google, say, well, we could do that. So I think it's probably small gains, little changes, making bigger changes. But, you know, certainly the vast majority of people I've spoken to who employ veterans, you know, companies that we speak to who support combat stress are very, very happy to almost, you know, positively discriminate and employ more veterans.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, you know, on the same token, I get reached out to a lot by companies similarly, and I see that as well. What I found interesting here in the US, and I'm not sure if you're seeing it, previously, a lot of DE&I statements actually didn't include veterans in their diversity, you know, goals. And I've seen a lot over the past few years where that's now, you know, becoming a big part of strategic initiatives and organizations. I'm not sure if you're seeing that as well.
Well, if we're not, if people aren't actively seeking to employ veterans, then they're missing out. I mean, the painting and decorating company is an exemplar, isn't it? Where he employed one veteran and said, "I want more of them." They're, you know, because of all these characteristics that somebody who has been in the forces bring to any role. So, you know, it's probably good for the P&L.
Absolutely agreed. And we love strong P&Ls, right?
Always do, yes.
Me working in sales, yes. But perfect. Okay, so what advice would you give to someone who's about to step into a civilian role, perhaps for the first time, right? I know, as you mentioned, it was such a vast difference, right? You had this kind of brotherhood, camaraderie around people every day. We're seeing remote working, hybrid working and whatnot, which I think can have a very big impact when you're working in person every day to things that, you know, those sort of environments. So any advice for kind of these younger generations that are coming out of the military and don't know how to make that new position feel the same?
I think it goes back to those two, you know, networking and a fear of failure. I think there are loads of opportunities to network, either remotely or in person. And I would strongly encourage people to build out a network as soon as they can, and try and maintain it. And talking to a variety of people also might produce other opportunities. There are jobs that exist now that weren't even conceived 10 or 20 years ago. And there are any of these opportunities are probably coming round more and more quickly as technology advances and companies try to harness some of that technology to improve their businesses. So I think networking is probably the key thing. And actually, I wish in many ways I had done and still do more of it. I guess it's akin to investment. The best piece of investment advice is you should have done it 20 years ago. And then the second best time to do it is now. Yeah, that's what I think that's probably what I would do. Continue to network.
Yeah. And I know we've kind of touched, I think, on a few of these topics, but not necessarily marketing yourself as you're exiting, you know, the military, right? Conscious that I think the UK charity SSAFA claimed that one third of recruiters were reluctant to hire veterans. So obviously you might not have the hard skills leaving the military, depending on what you were doing and what you're hoping to do. But what about those soft skills? How would you advise, you know, people market themselves or get themselves, you know, that foot in the door?
Well, if you feel that is an area of weakness, i.e. not being able to market yourself, then get help. And there's plenty of help out there. SSAFA, that's SAFA. I mean, there are things, you know, regimentally where you could ask for some help, or other organizations. There is plenty of help out there to help people put a CV together, to write a covering letter, all of those sorts of things. I am really, really bad at job interviews. Whenever I'm asked a question, even if somebody says, "And you know, what's your name?" I forget it. So I'm really bad.
You're doing really well here now.
I've had some interview coaching, and it was some of the best investment in myself actually that I've ever had, because there are lots of formulaic questions that require a formulaic response. And and the more you do it, the better you get at it. So yeah, I would ask for help in that sort of marketing thing, because there are ways of talking about some of your work experience in the armed services that you need to put into sort of civilianized language. But yeah, there's plenty of help out there. There's the Forces Employment Charity in the UK, which not only offer help and advice, but also placement too. So, and I do think, you know, mercifully, in spite of everything that's going on in the world at the moment, mercifully, you know, we're not on a war footing, and we're not in places like Iraq or Afghanistan or wherever the next flashpoint is going to be. So that's a good thing. And so people aren't coming back, you know, injured and wounded. But I think the next big thing is employment, and how do we harness this amazing resource of people who leave the armed services that have been extremely well trained and invested in by, you know, UK PLC, and to enter the workplace and use some of those skills to develop and grow the economy. So it just seems crazy not to try and tap into this excellent resource.
Absolutely. And I think one of the ideas that people have around veterans can often be, okay, you know, they're only suitable for certain roles or certain industries. Yeah. I see it a lot over here in the US, where maybe somebody did work as an engineer in the armed forces, but of course they're not using public cloud, right? It's a lot more high security, things of that nature. And I think immediately you get that bias of, well, we need somebody with cloud, right? Opposed to thinking, okay, imagine all the other skills they can bring with this level of experience. That's something that we can coach them up on. And as somebody who's probably had to learn quickly on their feet, they'll be able to do just that. Do you have, you know, any, I guess, what would you do, or how would you demystify, you know, the veteran journey after the forces and kind of debunk those sort of things internally, right? Or any advice, I think, for people who are wanting to do that in their HR departments?
I would rather have an enthusiastic and willing employee who would be happy to learn a new skill and be trained than somebody who came with all the right experience but was less enthusiastic. So I think a lot of it, so what I'm trying to say is, it's attitude of mind is probably the most important thing, rather than a particular skill set. And actually, if you look at the list, I've mentioned it, the employer recognition scheme. If you look at the list of, so it's gold, silver and bronze tiers, and you have to go through certain gates in order to go up from bronze to silver to gold. And if you look at the number of companies in the UK that have signed up to that, those are the ones that I would hope are really thinking about veterans, employing veterans. And so, you know, if you're leaving the services, that's probably where I'd start first. You know, look at those sorts of companies. Or if you're applying to a company, check whether they are part of the employee recognition scheme too, because you'd be in an organization that is on a journey towards understanding what being a veteran and what skills they can bring to your organization. So that's probably where I'd think about starting. But yeah, no, attitude of mind is the most important thing, I think.
Yeah, and I love that you brought that up, because I think it applies to everyone, right? I think when you go into an interview and you're able to sell your excitement, right, and why you want to. I actually had a previous employer, and his like main question they asked, like, dictated whether he's going to hire somebody or not, was, why do you need this job, right? Not why do you want it, but why do you need it? And I think it was really telling, just, you know, if people could be honest, right? Hey, I have, you know, a few kids at home, right? This is how I make my living. This company is exciting me for X, Y, and Z reason. And being able to sell back to that and have, I think, a bit more of a human touch to it, and just being honest with why you need it is crucial, and being able to portray that excitement across the board. So I really like that piece of advice. Say you had just left the forces, right? What could a prospective employer offer that would resonate with a candidate? I know we've talked a bit about cultures being warm, right? But I think a lot of people can say things. So from an on-paper perspective, what would be, you know, enticing to a candidate who's a veteran?
I think the most important thing is work out what your own personal values are and whether that organization aligns with those. Where I have been in an organization where my own personal values haven't aligned with either my boss or the organization, it hasn't been a good fit. Work out what makes you tick. What are your personal values? And if you don't stray far from those, I think you're generally going to be successful.
Agreed. Yeah. I think the boss is an interesting one as well, right? Because I've seen so many people in an industry that they love, right, historically have loved. But if that relationship isn't there and you're not able to get the best out of your team or them get the best out of you, then this ship can sink really quickly, so to speak.
Totally. And I think that comes back to that other piece of advice, you know, on failure. Bouncing out of a role is not, if you do it repeatedly, then there's a problem and it needs addressing. But, you know, if there is an occasion, two occasions where you think this is just not right, I need to move on, then move on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, I know we touched on kind of the advice that you would give your younger self or, you know, somebody who is in similar shoes to you that you were in. And now it's important to also look towards the future, I should say. So with that in mind, what piece of advice would you give to your future self?
Crikey. I think I've reached a stage in my career now where I am very happy doing what I'm doing. Whilst I have no burning career ambition in terms of I don't want to be a chief executive, I don't want to work for a massive organization, but I'm still very, very ambitious for what we do as a team, then that's fine. To have constant burning career ambition is not necessary. I think just trying to do the best job you can in the circumstances you are. That would be the advice I would give my future. So looking back on my career, you know, when eventually I retire, you don't have to have been in the top job. Just doing well at what you're doing and enjoying it is the most important thing.
Yeah, you don't have to be in the top job to do the top job, right? For yourself and for the organization.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. I also, I don't know if Matthew McConaughey is huge over here. I read his book recently, but I also had heard a speech that he gave, and he said similarly, like, you know, my hero is my future self, right? 10 years from now, and constantly chasing that goal. And he said, I'll never get to meet my hero, but I always want to chase the best version of myself. And I think, you know, that's really important. It's like, be okay with where you are, be happy, right? And take note of the good things that you've achieved, but also don't be afraid to continue to move that goalpost, you know, within reason.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Of course, he's
SSAFA. I'm like, I don't know what's common. What's not.
Don't worry. he's quite a big star globally, isn't he? But I think that's right. And actually, if I think about my working life up to this point, it's all been fine. It's all worked out. I've achieved, I've hit targets, I've done well. And actually, if I continue to apply myself in the way that I am now, then it will be fine in the future. So the advice is, it will be okay. As long as you're striving, your values are aligned, you're working hard, you're working for the right organ, all those sorts of things, it will be fine.
Absolutely. Perfect. And I guess final question here, because I'm conscious of the time and you probably want to get back to your day, but what's the biggest change that you want to see happen, you know, first in terms of equitable opportunities for veterans?
I think the guy that I met who was just blown away by that first veteran he employed, I just wish that was something that could percolate, you know, further through the employee opportunities in the UK. I think, you know, we're getting there. I've mentioned the employee recognition scheme. I think we're getting there. But, you know, the size of the armed forces means that most people aren't exposed to people who have served, and that is problematic. So, yeah, more of that guy talking about the best experience he's had by employing a veteran.
Yeah. Absolutely. And now I know I said that was my last question, but I'm taking that back. I want to kind of end the podcast a bit more learning about your organization, exactly what you all do. I'm conscious that a lot of people who listen to this, of course, are veterans, you know, work for corporations who might want to be sponsors. So can you maybe tell us, you know, us a little bit about A, you know, what you all offer, what you're doing in the space, and then B, if you know, for fundraising efforts and whatnot, how people could get involved to support.
Sure. Great. Thanks for the opportunity to do that. Thank you. The best way is to look at our website, combatstress.org.uk. And there's actually loads and loads of self-help resources there. So for bereavement, anger management, alcohol, all of that's on the website. We also have a 24-hour helpline. And actually, I learned that is, there are only three 24-hour helplines of this type in the UK. So, and that number is 0800 138 1619. And everybody who answers the telephone is a trained counsellor. So we talked about normalisation of the way you feel. often people call that and say, I'm just glad that I'm not the only person that's feeling like this. So almost the help starts there. We employ psychologists, psychiatrists, occupational therapists, art therapists, peer support workers, family support workers. So we actually do the work. We don't just fund it. We actually do the work. We're tri-service, so all branches of the military can apply, and it doesn't matter about your age. We've got, you know, people on our books in their 20s up to their 80s, all conflicts. And it's also free. That's where the support from the great British public comes in. They are very, very generous in the way that they support us. And one of the biggest things that corporates do for us is get involved in some of our challenge events. And one of the most successful is March in March, which is a 10-mile walk in March. And you organize it yourselves. Lots of companies like doing that because it allows people who work together to do something that is not work related. Yeah, exactly. So that's a really good event.
Perfect. I appreciate that so much. Well, thank you again, Robert, for your time. All, you know, hope that we can keep in touch here moving forward. And yeah, well, hopefully we can get you on again here soon.
Great. Thanks. A real pleasure to talk to you, Kendall. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you're hoping to kickstart a new career after leaving the forces, or you'd like support with hiring veteran talent into your business, please visit our website on www.exmilitarycareers.com or reach out to us directly on LinkedIn. The links are in the description. Until next time.